So, Governor, as I come visit you in Miami, how's Governor Jeb Bush doing?
Fantastic. Life is really good. I got 5 grandkids, 3 granddaughters here, 2 grandsons, as you know, in Austin. My family's blessed. I'm madly in love with my wife still after 48 years of marriage. Life is good.
I know even at any age, when you lose a parent, and I lost my mom the same year you lost your mom and your dad, it's tough.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the holidays without them there?
When you know, it's almost every day I think about my mom and think about my dad. Just through some interaction, someone will bring up some story. My mom and dad touched so many people, you know, I constantly think about them a lot. And so most of the time, it's with joy that I'm so blessed to be their son. Sometimes it can get a little sad, particularly around Christmas time.
Right, and people think just because you're older, it shouldn't matter, that happens, but it's not the case.
No, right. It isn't. But look, what a blessing to be George and Barbara Bush's son. I mean, that was just, talking about privilege, the term privilege.
Right.
When I woke up in Midland, Texas, 69 years ago, and almost 70 years ago, and there was Barbara Bush in the hospital bed next to me, that was luck.
Wow.
Pure luck.
And instead of looking as a burden to live up to, never like that.
Never. I mean, my dad, struggled with it as a teenager, probably. You know, the guy was like this hero, like godlike figure in my life. And then I realized, look, I think I had just gotten married when I was 21, and I figured if I could be half the man he is, I'll have lived a purposeful, successful life. So kind of the pressures of trying to reach the near perfection that I saw through my, you know, that I thought my dad was, that relief kind of made it easier for me to be an adult.
Will you get together on holidays with your family?
My immediate family, yes. George W. and the rest of my siblings, we get together in typically in August.
Wow. So this year, your dad lost elections, you've lost elections, and now your son lost his first election. He wanted to be Attorney General of Texas. How did George P. handle it, and what was it like for you? Was it hard for you as a dad?
You know, it's harder for the losses I've had were not as difficult for me as they were for my parents and for your family. Your family cares more about that. You figure out how to get through it. So George has handled it well. I was sad to see him lose because he was a really good public servant, and he's a young guy. He'll have a chance to get back into it.
Got it. Let's talk about what's happening in Florida and during the midterm elections. They expected what happened in Florida to be nationwide.
Yeah.
There was a red wave. Governor wins a resounding re-election. Why did Republicans not experience that? They get the House by a slim margin and they lose a seat in the Senate.
I don't know. I was surprised. Thank God I'm not a political pundit, because I would have been wrong.
But you know as much as just about anybody.
I just think that Florida is unique in the sense that conservatives have governed effectively. They haven't complained about how bad things are. They haven't said the Democrats are horrible. They've assumed the responsibility of leadership, and they've governed. And people get it. You know, you drive down our roads, they're crowded, but there's no potholes that, you know, break in your axle.
So it was performance.
It was a focus on education. Our universities have gotten better. We have this commitment to the long-term things like building roads and protecting water bodies in the state. And led by Governor DeSantis, Republicans get credit for that leadership. It was a total wipeout. I mean, there hasn't been anything like this in a long while. It was more than a red, it was a tidal wave. It was, I don't think the Democrats won a single race that was contested.
And you're a part of the Mutual Admiration Society with Governor Ron DeSantis. You've been watching what he's doing as a two-term, very successful governor. And you, to say the least, are impressed?
Yeah. No, I'm a big fan. And the time when it matters is the time of crisis. That's when particularly governors and mayors, I guess, to a certain extent, have to step up, put aside all of the hyper-partisanship that's kind of the norm in politics today, and serve and help people in their time of need. And he did that with the crisis that we faced
with Hurricane
Ian and the most recent hurricane, the collapse at Surfside. He worked with local officials, put aside the partisan differences. That's what people want, and he's delivered that.
You think that he's got the momentum, and is this the right time at 44 for him to run for higher office?
Yeah, I think it is, but he'll have to make that decision. My dad asked, when I was running, I was thinking about running for Congress in the 1980s, and I called my dad up, and I gave him all the numbers, and kind of went through the precincts and said, I could win. And then he asked me a question that I'll never forget. He said, what happens if you do win? And I said, what do you mean? Well, are you going to take care of your family? Are you going to move to Washington? Where are your kids going to go to school? Is your wife going to be happy? And it took me like 20 seconds to say what a stupid idea it was to run for office at that time. And I was about, I was probably 40. So the first step for anybody to run for office, particularly one of that magnitude, is what happens if I win? And he has to answer that question. Only he and his family can answer that.
He's got little kids.
Got little kids.
His wife coming off breast cancer.
Thrust into the limelight. It's pretty ugly out there right now in politics. But if he can get comfortable with that, I think he would be a really excellent candidate.
It's interesting. Senator Tom Cotton said, "I do have little kids, and I'm not running."
Yeah, and I respect that. I think the blind pursuit based on ambition, there's no good outcome. You got to be totally comfortable. The first things come first, which is, if you love your family, you need to make sure that they're the first priority. And sometimes it makes sense to do things, and sometimes it doesn't. So, whatever his decision is, I think he'll focus on that being the most important thing.
What's interesting, too, is one of the issues that some say they heard Republicans is they got what they wanted, Roe v. Wade overturned, and you're one of the most pro-life governors in the country when you served. And Republicans couldn't message it, and it looked like you were anti. They messaged it effectively, Democrats, as if you're taking rights away from women. Marco Rubio said, I'm pro-life, but Florida isn't, so I'm going to let Florida make Florida's decisions. Is there a right way to message the pro-life movement in a country that isn't predominantly pro-life?
Well, I think the wrong way to do it is the way Republicans did it, which was to ignore it. I mean, the Democrat position, the official platform basically is abortions up till a child being born. And that's a radical position, and that is not the mainstream position. There is some common ground that could be found. Florida's rules law right now is 15 weeks. I would have advocated, and hopefully the legislature will lessen that. But there's ways to message this by being on the playing field and advocating your position.
What is a good way to say it?
Well, it's to say, look, I don't believe that you should have partial birth abortion. I don't believe a teenager should have an abortion without notifying their parents unless there is a environment of abuse. I think there ought to be counseling for women that are confronted with this really extraordinarily difficult choice. They should be given options. And I think, they're after a certain amount of time, you can't terminate the life of a child. So you have to explain it, and you have to advocate it, and you have to do it with compassion and love. And
exceptions?
I support rape, and, I think that's another element you can get into, and there's a pretty good moral argument against that, but I think, the practicality is that exceptions probably should be part of a middle ground kind of policy.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com. Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Education. You watch Governor Youngkin really pull up one of the biggest upsets in Virginia, come out of nowhere to beat Terry McAuliffe, who just wanted four more years and he thought he would just walk to it. And many people point to those, what happened in Virginia, at that school board meetings where people stood up and the parents were told to shut up. You live and breathe education in this country. So what do you think about where we're at now and what should the position be? What's best for students?
Well, it's exciting that parents because they were the teachers of their kids during COVID in many places where the schools were shut down and access to the internet was non-existent, they had to become the teacher of their children. And the frustration they felt now can be mobilized to bring about meaningful reform. And so the foundation that I'm the chairman of works across the country in advocating parental choice, where parents can choose public and private options. We focus on early childhood literacy. There's this insidious idea that you can allow kids to learn to read by guessing the words, by three cueing, by going through a process where you look at the words and you kind of guess it rather than sounding out the words and learning what they mean. The science of reading is pretty well established now, but many states ignore that. So there's a big fight, and parents now engaged are incredibly important soldiers in this fight to assure that children have a fighting chance to gain the power of knowledge.
And the bottom line is, we're trouble a lot of states getting teachers at this point. That's a challenge. Number two is, in Arizona, you now can decide, I'm going to take the money advocated for me mm-hmm. for public school, and I could choose private. I personally would not have had the money growing up to go to a private school. If my public school was bad, I'm going anyway. Now in Arizona, they can make the choice.
Yep.
I'm curious to see how this is going to come out. And is that, to me, where we should be at with all 50 states?
Money should follow the child. That should be the mantra. Why do we protect a system rather than empowering parents to make choices? You have to assume that children, that moms and dads love their children with their heart and soul, and they can make the right decision if they are informed. If they're given the right information, they'll do what's right for their kids. And so the ESA, the Education Savings Account, can customize the learning experience, not just to attend another school, but also to get tutoring and other means. Governor Ducey and the legislature in Arizona get huge credit for this, and it's now a model. Florida has all sorts of options for parents. But the great thing of our system is that when one state does something like this, other states say, well, I'm gonna double down and try to do it even better. And so
creates a competition. Yeah. Makes the public schools better in theory.
Not theory. I mean, Florida created the first statewide voucher program when I was governor, and we've had an expanse of options, both public and private, for parents. And the public schools here have gotten better because all schools get better when parents are involved.
It's foreign to a Bush family, but there's a war on history in our schools. There seems to be a movement among teachers or among principals or superintendents to look at our past and see problems and maybe do it in a way in which America lasts. Have you noticed that?
I haven't noticed it around here. I've read about it. I've watched Fox and seen it on television a lot. And there are places clearly where teachers are acting on their own ideology.
That's grounded. Does it worry you?
Hell yeah, it worries me. The idea that somehow that we're so, you can admit that we, as a country, that it hasn't been a perfect ride. There are parts of our past that we need to understand so that we don't replicate that. But you don't have to hate the country to admit that some part of our history wasn't proper. And I think there's a growing belief that we're just systemically flawed to the core. And so if you're a young person that wants to pursue their dreams and you're told over and over again that the system is just broken and you're never going to be able to rise up, that's horrible. That is so un-American. And so my hope is that we have, meaningful civics education that addresses our past, for sure, but loves our country, that instills in people a sense that our future is going to be brighter than the past because we're America, damn it. I mean, I'm tired of, people tearing down our country.
There was Jim Crow. There was slavery.
Yeah.
There was a Civil War. There was segregation. You could tell that story and still tell the American story. And also, if you get a perspective on what was going on in the rest of the world, we didn't invent any of those things. Those things were happening. I think the story is how we fixed it, and we continue to try to make it better.
Exactly. And I kind of yearn for the day that Europeans would they used to look down their nose saying, you Yanks are way too, naively optimistic. I think it's important that we restore some sense of optimism about our country.
Get the swagger back.
And part of it is based on our past that has clearly our Constitution, our history, you've written about this, is so unique. And we are a special country in many ways. And if we don't believe that, we won't act on it.
Is that part of your education mission?
Sure. No, I think you know, there's a effort underway across the country now to focus on civics education that restores some sense of common identity in our country. Financial literacy as well is another place where high schools particularly need to act. And there's a growing consensus that we have to do these things now. Right. And look, the tearing down our country part, that's not just related to our K-12 education. That's you know, many institutions now, or leaders of institutions, seem compelled to embrace this woke ideology.
And you think that we could be getting through it when you see Jim Crow 2.0 wasn't the new law of the land in Georgia. The election was flawless and they had a huge turnout.
Yeah.
When you saw the blowback that Disney got from this governor when they decided to mislabel an education parental rights bill, a don't say gay bill, and you saw the unboxing of a Columbus statue in Philadelphia because they say it was donated in 1876, we can take it down. Do you think that we might be on the other side of woke?
I think we are getting there for sure. When Vanguard decides they're not going to be part of a climate council and vote their shares based on some ESG ideology that may hurt American jobs, for example, across the board, whether it's corporations, higher, you know, universities, K-12 education, a lot of these institutions that had been captured by some degree of wokeness, I think people are now realizing, look, I think maybe it's better to stay in our lane and do our job rather than expand our mission out to all these weird things that most Americans don't believe in.
Hey, it's Will Cain, co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. Join me as I share my thoughts on a wide range of topics, from sports and pop culture to politics and business.
The Will Cain Podcast. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
We are at the border, Fox, and put drones.
Yeah.
And just by telling the story, we're basically alone in doing it. Governor, you know immigration is not a new issue in America, but where with the dissolving in December 12th of Title 42. They expect 18,000 illegals to come to our border. What is it going to be like? We were having trouble handling 3. It's up to 8. What does 18 look like?
It looks like an uncontrolled situation that, for the refugees, the people that are crossing the border, it's really dangerous. And we're creating this incentive for them to come because they can't make their claim of persecution in their home host country, which is what we should do. And the policy that President Trump started, I think, is the proper one. And it created a decline in the number of people crossing because they knew that if they came, they weren't necessarily going to get into the country. Look, great nations, all nations, have the right to control their border. And we should have a commitment to legal immigration, but we can't let people get in the front of the line. You know, there are people that will pay 10 grand for a loved one to come. I don't blame them for that, but the policy of our country shouldn't be that they get the higher priority.
Are you astounded the President of the United States hasn't been to the border? And what do you get by going? What do you get by seeing?
Well, he doesn't have to go to the border. All he has to do is watch you guys on Fox and show it. It's clear that people are crossing the border, and then they'll come, they'll be allowed to go to Miami and other places where their loved ones are. They'll get a notice to come for their hearing about their claim of persecution and their request for asylum.
Yeah.
And then 2 years from then, 90% of them will be getting a deportation notice, and they won't come for that one. So this idea that, you know, we've blown up the immigration court system. There are backlogs galore, making it harder for even people who have been waiting patiently legally to come in. And, you know, President Biden should go to the border to show his support for law enforcement officers that have a really difficult time. And now you have fentanyl, which has replaced heroin as this devastating drug for communities all across the country, all of which, or most of which, is coming through Mexico. This should be a higher priority. And for whatever reason, Democrat leadership in Washington seems to think that this is a salient political issue to to support open borders. I think working people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, want our borders controlled.
But you have Senator Schumer on camera, Senator Harry Reid on camera, talking about the need to have a strong border and build a wall. He wanted 500 miles of wall. Joe Biden signed on for 500 miles of wall. What happened?
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense because normally, you know, good policy and good politics is the nice intersection you want to be in. And this is bad policy and bad politics. This is not a place where Democrats win politically.
Looking on the 2024 landscape, there's a lot of talent on the right. And I think even people on the left would say that. If you look at Tim Scott, you look at Rick Scott, you look at Ron DeSantis, the former president is going to be in the mix to that. You think that Mike Pompeo is probably going to do it. Mike Pence is going to be in. It's hard to think on that stage and see people without merit and accomplishment. How would you rate it?
No, I think there'll be a lot of people running. There's no entrance requirement. You know, the barriers of entry are pretty low. People can run with maybe an outside chance to win. Because there's, you know, no harm, no foul. The key to me is, are people qualified to serve? Do they have a servant's heart? And there is a big group of really talented people that potentially will run for president, for sure, that are qualified and that could lead our country.
Do you think that Ron DeSantis is head of that class?
I mean, if you look at the polls, he's certainly way ahead of everybody else, including President Trump.
Governor, what about for you? If a Republican is to get into office and they were to say, Jeb Bush, we need some help, would you go to Washington?
Let me check my 8-ball. 8-ball says outlook not so good. No, I mean, look.
You mean you look great, look young, you look like you run a marathon?
I can't do that, but I do think it's important for new blood to get into policymaking in Washington. It looks pretty stale to me. And the fighting that goes on, it's almost as though, like, solving it, like the immigration issue shouldn't be a partisan issue. We have a problem. Let's solve it. Let's solve it in a comprehensive way. Let's control the border. That, 20 years ago, that would have been kind of the standard operating procedure. Now, people think, well, this is a wedge issue that I can win if I just keep hammering home how bad the other side is. And this great country is now being diminished because we're not solving our fiscal problems. We're not solving a lot of challenges. So, you know, bringing people with a fresh perspective that have a proven record of solving problems, I think is important. And I kind of think they ought to be younger too, for crying out loud. We got a bunch of old fogies in D.C. these days, all of whom, you know, have served. I got no problems. This is not a personal issue, but why is it that in politics now you have to be over 80 to be in a, you know, committee chair or something like that?
Right. President's over 80. Would you be surprised if President Biden ran again?
I don't know. The issue there is, can I serve? And he has to make up his mind on that.
How has he done?
He's done, and some things I think he's done okay, and other things it's been a disaster. The spending... kind of, this is one thing I do think Republicans need to get back in the game on, which is fiscal policy. I mean, we're giving drunken sailors a really bad name right now. The amount of money that is being appropriated on everything is a burden for my grandchildren that is hard to imagine how
over
we get.
Over $30
trillion. It's horrible. And, you know, you can't compromise by saying, okay, you get what you want and I'll get what I want, and it's just more spending. These deficits are devastating.
Earmarks are back. And an omnibus is queued up, bill to get us to fund
that
the government.
No one reads. That's like this thick, and it's gonna, you know, it's gonna keep the government open, but the amount of lard in that thing is gonna be disgusting.
But who's gonna get elected if they say we gotta rein in social programs, we gotta rein in Medicaid, you got Social Security's insolvent, hey. Medicare, Obamacare doesn't work. If who's gonna get elected cutting back things that people are getting?
The candidate that describes what the disaster is if we keep doing what we're doing now. You know, that would be, for me, the candidate that describes that we're living way beyond our means, that we're destroying the chance of children and grandchildren to have a purposeful life, I would support that person. And it's been consistently bad because there's not a balanced budget requirement in D.C., as there are in every state. but it's gotten massively worse. And President Biden was proposing like triple what he got was more than, which was more than any president in modern times has actually received in terms of the budget.
But it's all towards.
Had his agenda gotten passed, it would have been lights out.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
But what about the transition? You're environmentally conscious. What about the transition to green energy? Are we on the right track?
There was this week, there is an announcement out of one of the great labs, energy labs in our country, that they have found fusion. They found a way to create more energy than it takes for fusion. To me, the answer is just American ingenuity, American innovation, basic research, the best and the brightest people, not outside of, not mandates by Washington to protect one industry at the expense of the other, but find the transition based on innovation. That's America at its best. And so I'm totally confident that there are solutions to these environmental challenges that we face without devastating our economy and pushing people away from high-wage jobs. And so, but the approach by the so-called, whatever the thing, the
Inflation Reduction Act.
Come on, you gotta be kidding me. But that, this is like a Kafka novel, that bill is picking winners and losers rather than saying, let's invest in our future by basic research and allow for American entrepreneurship and ingenuity to find these answers.
Have you identified China as our number one threat economically and militarily?
Yeah, there's no question they're still in their ascendancy, although they have huge problems that we should, we should constantly find ways to work with China. We can't have a perpetual enemy because of the dangers that brings to the American people. But their challenges are far worse than ours, if you think about just demography alone. They have a growing elderly population, family formation rates at an all-time low, the one-child policy created 20% more men than women for how many, two generations or close to a generation and a half. That's going to play out in a really ugly way in their country. So the miracle of China may not be may not look so pretty in the next decade or two, but they are a threat. And I think President Biden gets credit for curbing semiconductor sales. Didn't get much attention.
The chips bill.
Yeah, the bill itself is to promote domestic production, but he also by decree, I think. I guess he has the power to do this, stopped exports of chip technology into China, which will slow down their progress in perhaps the most important industry that we have.
Originally a Republican proposal, I thought, too. Now, lastly, and you're the expert, but I think after this last election and knowing that independents are the fastest growing group in this country, I think that most candidates realize that you cannot win with your party alone. And do you think that it's now going to become an asset to show where you can compromise? Or are they going to get to the primary process, get extreme again, and go down the same lanes?
That's kind of work in progress, isn't it? Because it's hard to tell if there is a large number of people that don't play the hyper-partisan game, don't like it, don't follow it, don't care for it. But they're not in the primaries. They're not voting in the primaries necessarily. So I think the key is for candidates to be talking about the future, to be hopeful and optimistic again, rather than just say how bad things are. I don't know about you. I think we're in a great country. And I'd rather be 21 than 69 for a lot of reasons.
Right.
But, the future is incredibly bright. But we have politicians moping around saying the end is near.
Right.
And I just don't see how that's a winning message for independents.
Education's dear to you.
Yeah.
And when the president, when the governor was upset about some of the curriculum in schools, he put out a parental rights bill, which was wrongly labeled the Don't Say Gay bill. which the word gay is not even in this bill. Could you talk about the turbulence that you witnessed, the approach to the bill, and the resolve?
Well, it's pretty much, it's a good example of this new political environment where people don't even read the bill. Someone coins it as a don't say gay bill that stifles speech, you know, of all ages. And when in fact, the bill simply said that up till fourth grade, parents are in charge of the, you know, sexual orientation and all this, you know, all this discussion about sex. I mean, that's an 85% to 90% issue, and Governor DeSantis defended it effectively, and he should have. I mean, this is, look, at the end of the day, this is a, you know, there are places in the state of Florida where people were talking about inappropriate things to young kids. It's not common, it's not all over the place, but it's there, and I think it's appropriate for the legislature to pass a law like that. The overreaction just made his views, I think, even more powerful, and how he responded to that. Again, he's got this pretty good knack of figuring out who to go after once they've taken these crazy positions.
And with Disney was one of the people that took those positions and condemned the bill from pressure they say from their employees. Can you talk about the battle as that unfolded, and what were you thinking? Because you know the importance of Disney.
Disney's
to
huge.
Florida and to Orlando.
Look, 80,000 employees. We don't have an income tax because people go to Disney. Our sales tax revenues are paid for by 20% of the sales tax revenue, more or less, are paid for by visitors. So it's hugely important. So I think it's important to recognize how important Disney is to the state, but also take a stand against these woke employees that temporarily were kind of running the asylum there. I would love for Disney to come to Florida. Where, you know,
we're their headquarters.
Yeah, why not? I mean, this is a live and let live state. We don't impose wokeness, and we allow for freedom of speech and allowing people to have their own views. Look, I mean, if a liberal says something in Florida, they're not pushed out, they're not canceled, they're not any of that stuff. This is a place where woke goes to die, as Governor DeSantis says, but it's also a place where people of real diversity can come and pursue their dreams. Disney would be fantastic if they moved their headquarters here.
But instead, they lost their autonomous status within the next 2 years, and they lost their CEO. Back comes Bob Iger. So so you have this governor taking on 60 Minutes, a politician slayer sometimes, and excels. Then he takes on Disney. And as of right now, how did that play out? Would you have done the same thing?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think I would have punished Disney for the foolish nature of a few 20-something employees that, for whatever reason, the CEO felt caved to.
Right.
I'd give them a break. And now that this is over and people, you know, can look at this freshly, hopefully the legislature and we have a new CEO. Bob Iger understands the role of Florida plays in Disney. He understands how important Florida is. And he's, you know, he's very savvy. My guess is that they'll figure out a way to resolve this.
So one of the things that Ron DeSantis did is, seeing the legal immigration issue, there were planes landing in Jacksonville unannounced with illegal immigrants, dropped off without telling the governors. He decided, and might do again, to take a plane load of immigrants on, signed a piece of paper, and they went to Martha's Vineyard. It didn't go over big to the people of Martha's Vineyard, but it certainly sent a message and had people talking about it.
Yeah.
Is that one of the things that, as governor, you think was a good move?
They used state money for it. I wouldn't have done it. I'm a conservative. I don't think we should be spending money on stuff like that. Here's the deal. What we should be doing is fixing our immigration policy. We shouldn't be allowing millions of people to be coming across our border and then migrating on their own to Martha's Vineyard and other places, which is what they're doing. And they're basically pushing back people who have been patiently waiting to come legally to our country to the back of the line. That is just wrong. And, you know, 90% of the American people believe that's wrong.
But you see the governor of Texas also getting frustrated. He's overwhelmed.
Yeah.
The governor
I know. They have every right to be, I mean, particularly Texas and Arizona, completely agree with that.
So if the federal government
but
doesn't
solve
do
it,
what do you do?
Solve it rather than use it as a political tool.
But if you can't get the president to pick up the phone and even go and visit you or entertain you.
That's the problem. That's the problem with D.C. right now, is 90% of the American people don't think we should have open borders. And yet, for how long has it been since we can't find common ground to solve this problem? I guarantee you, if Doug Ducey or Greg Abbott got in a room with the president and said, here's a comprehensive way, a bipartisan way to solve this problem, and brought the, you know, the Democrat members of the Congress from those delegations around the table. They would solve this problem. But everybody uses it for a wedge issue, and it's really frustrating.
So you understood why he did it, but you wouldn't have done it.
No, I mean, I was shocked that the state legislature funded $20 million of state money for it. Okay. It's like, wow.
But it did get people talking about it.
It sure did. It sure did. And it propelled him even further up the, you know, into the in the minds of a lot of voters very frustrated with this issue.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.